This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, comic and actor Phoebe Robinson, is the co-host and co-creator, along with Jessica Williams, of the comedy podcast Two Dope Queens, which also had a series of HBO specials this year. Robinson also hosts the interview podcast So Many White Guys. She was a writer for the TV series Portlandia, and next year she'll be in the movie What Men Want, starring Taraji P. Henson. Robinson's book, You Can't Touch My Hair and Other Things I Still Have to Explain, was a bestseller. Her new book, Everything's Trash, But It's Okay, is a series of funny, conversational, personal essays on subjects including being a feminist, nearly getting evicted when she was going broke trying to make it as a comic, going from a 4-year relationship to being single again, and then being in a relationship again, and what it's been like as a black woman to be in interracial relationships. Phoebe Robinson, welcome to Fresh Air. It is a pleasure to have you on our show. So you started in comedy about 8 years ago?
10 years.
Okay, okay. Yeah. So what was the gender, race, atmosphere in comedy clubs like for you then?
I think it's the same as it is now. It's a lot of straight white guys, some women, some people of color, a few queer people. You know, it's a very white, straight male dominated industry. And that can be exhausting, I think is probably the most polite way to put it. There's just a way that it seems like a lot of the white straight guys want comedy to be done. And if you don't do it that way, if you don't do sort of the hanging out that you do, I think it can feel sort of lonely in a way that I would say almost none of the other things I do, writing, acting, Two Dope Queens, that stuff doesn't feel lonely, but a lot of times stand-up feels incredibly lonely for me.
You know, you write that male comics talk all the time about their body functions and their man mm-hmm. parts, but if women do it, it's considered gross. So mm-hmm. what kind of reactions did you get when you were starting in comedy, when you started to talk about yeah. body issues and things like menstruation? And yeah. there were a lot of, you know, men in the audience.
Yeah, I mean, I think I just want to be clear that when anyone starts doing stand-up, like, you're full trash, you know what I mean? Like, you're just, like, not that great. You're really sort of coasting on personality, and you're hoping your jokes are kind of funny. And, you know, I've been doing comedy for 10 years, and I think I've finally gotten to a place where can I curse? Is that allowed?
No. We'd have to bleep it, so why bother?
I don't want to do that. Yeah, I don't want to. I don't want to do it. I'm not Lil Wayne. Okay, I'm not going to curse. So I just really got to a place. You know, I think honestly, the place that I got to happened when I went on tour last fall with Alana Glazer. We did our YQY tour across America, and we were both kind of being like, oh, we're funny. We've been doubting ourselves this whole freaking time. And a lot of that has been informed by the fact that we have different energy than a lot of the male comics. We carry ourselves differently. Maybe we tell our jokes in a different way or a different style. And we were beating ourselves up and allowing that sort of kind of patriarchal sort of energy to affect our self-esteem. And then I was like, yeah, I'm good at this job. I was gonna quit doing stand-up. Honestly, after that tour, I was going to be like, all right, I did one stand-up tour. I'm done. I won't do stand-up anymore. I don't fit in. And then I was like, why are you allowing this to overpower you?
Okay, you also say in your book that you made jokes when you were starting that you wouldn't dream mm-hmm. of making today. Can I put you on the spot mm-hmm. and ask you for an example of a joke you wouldn't dream of making today?
Yeah, I had this one joke that I used to do pretty early out, and I took all my early like stand-up clips off YouTube because who needs to see that train wreck? I don't. I was just Dunkirking it up. But anyway, so the joke basically is I was watching a slavery documentary with a white friend of mine. It got like really awkward, and I was like, oh, don't worry about it. Because I'm lighter skinned, I would have been in the house. And it always got a laugh, and I would, like, go and, like, make jokes about, like, you know, me and Thomas Jefferson. And I was just kind of like, now I'm like, are you kidding me, dog? Why would you ever make that? It's so ignorant, and it's so just kind of like, you know, when you're early, you're like, oh, I got to be provocative. I have to be edgy. I have to, like, if I'm going to talk about race, I have to do it in, like, this crazy way that I think has never been done and make people uncomfortable or make people, like, really just, like, kind of laugh out of, like, shock rather than laughing out of, like, truly, like, enjoying that joke thoroughly. And that is a joke where I'm like, maybe you like just don't need to joke about slavery like that. I'm sure there's a great slavery joke, but I haven't cracked that nut yet. And it's fine for me to not tell garbage ones in the meantime.
So you talked about your discomfort in comedy clubs performing mm-hmm. when you started out, and it took you till like last year.
Yeah, I know.
Like you could really do it. But you and mm-hmm. Jessica Williams started the comedy podcast Two Dope Queens. And you know, mm-hmm. you also just talked about wanting to do comedy in an environment where queer people and trans people could come and not feel like they risked being the butt of a joke. But yeah. that's how it is on Two Dope Queens. I mean, when you and Jessica Williams, who's your partner on that show, mm-hmm. put it together, like what was your goal in terms of the kinds of comics you wanted to showcase? Because it starts with you and her, you know, talking in a funny way about things that recently happened to you, and then you bring up several you know, stand-up comics to perform it, and it's done from a theater. So what was your goal in terms of showcasing comics and creating a type of environment for the audience and for the performers?
The fact that it's on HBO now, we started working together 4 years ago, is truly bonkers, crazy banana sandwich in the best way possible. And when Jess and I met, and just even before her and I met, I just would always notice, like, I would watch these late night shows, and it usually be, you know, straight white guys getting these opportunities, and every once in a while you see a woman, or every once in a while you see, like, a black guy, and I would just see it and I'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, all these people are funny. I'm not taking anything away from the people that did get those spots. But I'm like, I'm surrounded by so many funny women, so many funny people of color, so many funny queer people who might not get those same opportunities to submit their tape to a booker, to get greenlit, to talk about different things from their perspective. And so when Jess and I met, we were just kind of like, we know so many hilarious people who don't have maybe the platform they can to express themselves in a way. And we're like, well, it would be really dope, no pun intended, but it would be really dope to not only have a show that sort of showcases, you know, my improv and Jess's improv abilities, both singular and together, but also use the show as a platform to just bring our friends along and be like, we're supporting everybody. This is a show for everybody. If you are funny, there's no reason why you're not going to be on this show. And I think a lot of times you would just hear, you know, in the industry, oh, there's just like aren't any funny black women, or we just like don't know where to look. And I'm like, that excuse doesn't fly with me anymore. There are so many talented, amazing people. And if you're not booking them, it's either out of laziness or the fact that you really don't care.
So you're pretty successful now in comedy and with your podcast and the HBO specials mm-hmm. of Two Dope Queens. But for years, you made next to nothing as a comic.
Yes.
Yeah. And you were getting like dunning calls from the student mm-hmm. loans that you owed. You were nearly mm-hmm. evicted from your apartment, but you were given a reprieve of like several weeks or a couple of months to raise the $5,000 that you needed to stay in your apartment. How did you mm-hmm. handle the anxiety of not being able to pay your student loans and then not being able to afford to have an apartment and nearly being evicted?
Yeah, you know, there were a lot of tears, just like not being able to sleep at night. There was a lot of feeling like a failure, a feeling like maybe me trying to pursue comedy is a little nutty, because I really didn't start making a really solid living at doing comedy until 8.5 years in. And, you know, I was kind of like, well, maybe it shouldn't take this long. There are other people around me where it's like, it's not taking them 8 years to like sort of like, you know, get their career going the way that they want it. And, you know, looking back on it now, I'm just kind of like, you can't control when that happens. I think, yes, it was kind of irritating that it took me this long, but I think I was so fully ready for the opportunities that arose by that point. So like, you know, Two Dope Queens being on HBO didn't scare me. Having to write a book didn't scare me. It's like, okay, I've been blogging and writing for 3-4 years, making what, $50 a blog post? Okay, yeah, I can. This writing this book is going to be hard, but I'm not going to run away from it.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is comedian and actor Phoebe Robinson, who hosts the podcast Two Dope Queens with Jessica Williams. They co-host it together, and they also have a series of four HBO specials by the same name, and they have four more set for 2019, right, Phoebe?
Yes, I'm so excited.
Yeah, and now Phoebe has a new book called Everything's Trash, But It's Okay. You and your brother went to a private Catholic high school, and you say that you were one of two or three black students in the whole school, and you were the only black person in your graduating class. Why did your parents send you there?
Oh, I was the only black girl in my graduating class.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there was four of us black students in the graduating class, and I was the only black girl. You know, my parents are huge into education, and they are just like, that is the key to everything. They were like, if you want to have like a really full, happy, like fulfilled life, education is the way to go. So they sent us to Gilmore Academy, and it was, my brother totally like excelled and, you know, was like an A student and like Mr. Popular and like truly just like rocked it out. And I was a hot mess. Like, I like was such a slacker. But yeah, so I ended up going to Gilmore, and I was kind of like coasting and like not really like living up to my potential, which infuriated them so much. But yeah, I think they just wanted us to have like all the advantages they could possibly give us in life. And I think even though I was kind of like a crummy student there, I think I did learn a lot. Like, I did work study there. So I think from like a young age, like 14, 15, I always like was learning, you have to like earn your keep. You have to like work hard to be able to be in the place that you're in.
So when you weigh the discomfort of being like the only black girl in your graduating class with the fact that you probably did get a really good education, how does the balance come out?
I think in the end, I think it was worth it. I will say it would have been nice if there was another black girl in my grade. I think there was like one black girl in my class, and there was one Indian girl and one Asian girl. And I'm sure we, you know, not to be like, it's nice to have like a matching set, but it would have been nice if we could have each like, you know, looked across, you know, during mass and saw someone else who looked like us. Whenever we talk about like representation, like diversity, I don't think sometimes people fully understand how hard it is to not see yourself, especially if you're living in a society or a culture where you are so reflected at every possible turn. I think it's hard to like imagine what it's like to not have that. And so, you know, I do think that like if there was like a Two Dope Queens, that would have been a game changer for me to just like hear two black women, like young black women. LOL, I'm like 34, but I'm like, hey, young black women. But, you know, to hear two like young black women talking about, oh, this one time I got my hair done at this salon and they did this to my hair and like totally like messed it up. I couldn't talk about my black hair woes in high school with like Laura. She doesn't know. She just wakes up and she has flawless, like straight hair. Like, she didn't have to go through like what I had to go through. And so I think in the end it worked out okay, but I did have to do a lot of work on myself. I did have to kind of like be okay with being outnumbered in a way and not letting that make me so sad. And then also I think I was very lucky to be a child in the 90s with like Moesha, you know, Martin, Family Matters and Girlfriends and all these sort of shows where you could still see, you know, like Tracee Ellis Ross, or I could still see like Queen Latifah or Kim Fields and be like, oh, okay, cool. So I could kind of see what I could be like if I was, you know, an older black woman.
You write about body image in your book, and you say,
yeah,
since you were 14, your brain has been consumed with all the ways your body is like not good enough, meaning not attractive to straight dudes, and for failing to meet fashion industry standards. And you say even at age 34, with a deeper understanding of how we've been conditioned to have unhealthy relationships with our bodies, you're still kind of fixated on it. So how have you tried to like overcome that? Because it sounds like your like intellectual knowledge of how women have been expected to conform to certain body standards is at a different place than your just kind of visceral, like, I gained too much weight kind of feelings?
I think that everyone has that sort of battle inside themselves about something, whether it's body or, you know, I'm a writer with no other analogies. Great. Moving on. But you know what I mean? There's always that thing that it's like that you mentally, you know better, but conditioning still makes that self-doubt come. And so I think what I have done is I have chosen to refocus that energy. Like, I'm getting back into exercising, but not, like, I don't have a scale in the house. I'm like, it is not about a number. If you're just going, like, I need to make sure I'm strong enough to get through the day, rather than I want to make sure I look in these pair of jeans, I feel more powerful. The little bit of experiences that I have gotten with, like, styling and doing, like, these photo shoots, and again, these are champagne problems. I just want to preface, I know that. But they'll be like, oh, yeah, we only have a size 4. And it's like, that is unacceptable to me. To only have a size 4 is truly ignorant and inexcusable. Or I go to these, like, shoots and I tell people I'm a 10-12. That's just what it is. And they'll be like, here's a 6. It's like, how dare you? Truly, it's like, how dare you be like, oh, well, we couldn't find anything in your size. You didn't look, because I dress myself every day. Yeah. See, I dress myself every day and I find everything I need. This sort of, oh, well, we only have a 0-2-4, so you either fit in that or you're screwed, is not how you should treat anybody. I would do these fittings and 90% of the stuff I wouldn't fit into. And every time I didn't fit into something, I'd be like, I'm sorry.
Every single time.
I would apologize after every single outfit didn't fit. I'm like, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, they knew what size I was for weeks before I showed up. It is not my fault I'm the size that I am.
There's an afterword, an addendum to your book. And part of your book is about being single and the ups and downs of being single. And then the addendum is, I have a boyfriend now. Well, I had a BF at the time I turned this into my book editor. So you're still together?
Yes, we are still together. We're 15 months, 16 months? I'm pretending like it's a child. 16 months. We're doing great. And we just moved in together.
On which coast? Because he was from Portland, I think, living in Portland, and you're in New York.
Yes. He's originally from Bournemouth in the southern UK, and then he moved to Portland, and now he moved to New York for me. I do my terrible British accent all the time for him, and he loves it. That's not at all.
So you were single for at least 2 years in between your previous boyfriend and the person who you're with now. What have you learned about yourself from the periods where you were single and lived alone?
Before I met British Bake Off, that's what we call him. Before I met him, I really love romantic comedies. And I really was like, wanted to have that moment in my life where I'm like dating this guy. And then he just is like, gives his verbal approval or whatever about me and is like, you're amazing. And then that would make me realize I'm amazing. And then we would have this happy life together. And so that was like one of the biggest lessons, was like not looking for this great relationship to sort of define me or make me realize that I'm lovable. I just had to sort of figure that out for myself and be okay if I don't date someone for 2 years or 2.5 years or 5 years. And if I haven't like found my soulmate or my partner by then, does that mean that I'm a terrible person? You know what I mean? It's like all these like value systems you like place on yourself. And it was all predicated on what someone else thought about me. Never once did I check in and see how I felt about myself.
Did you have to learn how to fully enjoy yourself when you were not with somebody? Whether it's going to a movie by yourself or having dinner by yourself. And just feel like, I'm consuming this, I'm watching this, and I don't need somebody with me to fully appreciate the experience.
Absolutely. I mean, I did all that stuff where I just, and you always think like you go out to like a diner or a movie, you go by yourself, and you think everyone is just like dropping, like you're at a restaurant, everyone's dropping their forks and they're going, there is a woman single by herself. Ain't nobody, they're all like focused on their quinoa. They are not thinking about you, you know? And it just was so sort of like self-absorbed where I'm like, everyone's judging me for being single. And yes, there are certain people in everyone's lives who will like judge them for being single, but it was just kind of like, who cares? Big whoop. Am I not going to enjoy my life? Am I just going to put my life on pause until I find a partner to do stuff with?
Your boyfriend is white. And yes. you say that
he's OG white because he's British, honey.
You write, when you're in an interracial relationship, mm-hmm. you get mail or queries from black men wanting to know why you're not with a black man. And then you mm-hmm. write, funny, when I'm single, these same black dudes aren't asking me out. So elaborate on that for us.
Well, you know, I just want to preface, most of my life is me not getting asked out. Like, this is not, you know what I mean? Just to be clear, I'm not Rihanna where guys are throwing themselves at me. So I just think in general, I'm like not getting asked out a lot. And I used to just be like, I will just wait for a guy to ask me out. Like, I really was sort of, and my mom didn't teach me that sort of like cuckoo behavior, but I was like, I'm just going to wait for a guy to, so that's like truly how I was dating. And I would just wait for someone to ask me out. And if no one asked me out, I just wouldn't date, which is so ignorant. And also like, huh? What you talking about? You got a job. You can ask people out. So, you know, that's just really where I was. And so, you know, I think interracial dating is just really tricky for a lot of people, because I think a lot of times people want to find a reason for why you're not dating within your tribe. And I'm always just kind of like, you just meet who you meet. And if the timing is right, like I met British Bake Off at a U2 concert, LOL, truly like hilarious, because his band was opening for U2 at the time. And, you know, we sort of hit it off, like not even right away. I was like, I don't care about this guy. I'm just like focused on U2. But like eventually I realized British Bake Off was like kind of dope. And then we just ended up dating from there. But again, that was not, it just wasn't pre-planned. I like didn't even like really give him a second glance when I met him.
So I've mentioned that you and Jessica Williams host two dub mm-hmm. queens. You have your own podcast mm-hmm. called So Many White Guys, in which you interview people as opposed to doing stand-up. Mm-hmm. And
I interviewed you. It was a great episode.
And that was really fun. I really enjoyed that a lot. I was really glad I did that. So how did So Many White Guys get its name?
Well, because, you know, most podcasts are hosted by white guys, and okay. then they interview other white guys, and you're like, cool. Cool. So you're gonna have steak and eggs every day? Okay. Enjoy your life. And so I just kind of wanted to be like, I'm going to poke fun at like, there's so many white guys, but actually the thing is there's only one token white guy per season. The rest of the episodes are just women, queer people, people of color, and those are like the majority of the guests.
So now that you're starting to be cast in roles, do you look at casting calls or the equivalent? And because you write something very funny about that in your first book, but are there a kind of casting calls where you know that they are not, they're definitely like not entertaining the idea of having a black person in that role? Like, is there any kind of coded language that you can see when a black person would even conceivably be cast in the role?
The lead? You're like, oh, so the lead's going to be Renee Zellweger? Cool. Okay, so I'm the best friend. Okay, cool. I got that. You want me to sound like this? Okay. I'm not going to do that. But I say there were two big things that I, you know, when I started acting like pretty recently, I had to have a conversation with myself before even like going to my agents or whatever. And I was always like, I don't want the thankless part of a wife answering a damn phone call from her husband and giving him some motivation. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be on the other line being like, you got this, baby. I have no agency, no life. I'm just at home holding unfolded laundry. I will never, you will never see, I hate to use the word never, but you will never see me on screen holding a basket of unfolded laundry I will not do it.
Wait. If you were living alone and doing your own laundry, that would be perfectly fine.
That's okay. But if I'm like on the phone with Channing Tatum and he's out, you know, freaking saving the president, and I'm at home stepping on a Lego but folding his, you know, gym shorts, that's not the part for me. You know, I think the language in a casting call is like, all American is white. Beautiful but doesn't know it is white. And then usually it'll be like open to all ethnicities is when you know that that is that's a role that's they can envision someone not white doing it. But it's like all the roles should be open to ethnicity. Do you know what I mean? Like there is no reason why it took, you know, 20 some odd years for there to be a Crazy Rich Asians. There's no excuse for that. They could have been leads in romantic comedies this whole time. And so whenever I see that stuff, I always like think about like, because I have a niece and she's 5. As long as it's like not inappropriate in terms of language or sex, is this a part that when she gets older, would I be embarrassed to show her that I did? You know what I mean? And so that's kind of always like sort of my needle and how I operate. And it's hard being in an industry where, you know, if you're not the mainstream sort of thing, you're just not going to be considered. But I think on the flip side, what's great right now is that this is an industry where creators shine, where they can swim, where you can have like an Issa Rae, you can have, you know, a Phoebe and Jessica do Two Dope Queens. You can have an Abby and Alana. You can have all these sorts of people sort of just creating their own opportunities in their own lanes.
Well, Phoebe Robinson, it's just been great to have you on our show. Thank you so much.
Terry, and honestly, this has been the delight of my life, and we gotta hang out. I know we're supposed to see Bruno Mars together, and we couldn't do it.
No, because we're both working so hard.
Yes. Yeah. So hard. Just let me know. Who do you want to see? Def Leppard? Who do you want to see?
I'll pass on that one.
Let's go see Beyonce. Together. Yeah, we'll
sure.
See Beyonce.
Yeah, yeah. You get the tickets. Phoebe Robinson's new collection of comic personal essays is called Everything's Trash, But That's Okay. After a break, Maureen Corrigan will review the new novel, Washington Black, about a runaway slave. Then we'll hear from the author, Essie Adujan. This is Fresh Air.